This is Ozarks at Large for December 13th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas. Support for KUAF comes from the Community Clinic, helping people lead healthy lives by providing health care in Northwest Arkansas for over 12 years, with locations in Springdale, Rogers, Siloam Springs, and Fayetteville. On the web at communityclinicnwa.org. Healthy people, healthy community.
On this edition of Ozarks, a comprehensive report about education in Northwest Arkansas. We'll talk to two of the people who helped put it together, and they'll tell us why the report is intended to produce questions, not necessarily answers.
And the Christmas music extravaganza continues. We have previews of this weekend's Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra concert in Bentonville, and a quick conversation with Jim Brickman about his Monday night show in Fayetteville.
First, Senators Mark Pryor and John Bozeman of Arkansas have filed the Farmer Protection Act of 2012, a bill they say will help protect rice growers and hunting in the state. Senator Pryor says the growing season was abnormal this year due to drought, which caused some problems.
Because of this year's growing season and the weather and all that, you actually had more rice left over in the fields, basically, and some new rice was sprouting. And bottom line is the national fish and wildlife people looked at that and said, well, that is hunting over a baited field for duck hunting. Well, that's not what they're doing. That was never the intent.
Senator Pryor says the bill would clarify rules so certain policies don't hamper rice farming and duck hunting in the state. Senator Bozeman says farmers are being penalized unjustly for practices that have been approved by agriculture officials at the state and federal level.
Our rice farmers were just doing what rice farmers do, you know, in the sense of getting as much production as they can out of their land. Certainly, you know, we're so proud of being the duck hunting capital of the world, and so that industry is very, very important to the state. So it's just one of those areas that nobody intended to do anything wrong.
Both of Arkansas senators say waterfowl hunting contributes about $100 million a year to the state's economy.
The city of Taneytown is one step closer to having its own city-run police department. That's after Mayor Tommy Granata announced yesterday that Denny Upton will be the city's new police chief. Granata says that Upton has unique qualifications for this position.
He has run departments before. He is retired police chief for Springdale Police Department. He's run departments in, I think it was Buena Vista, Colorado, and I believe another department as well out there, and is currently working for the city in Johnson and their police department, and just got a lot of law enforcement in his background.
Granata says that about 20 people applied for the chief's job, with Upton hired as the town's top cop. Granata says that much of the remaining work to set up the police department lies in procedural hurdles.
First thing, the chief's got to go get certified, so it'll take a little bit of time for him to get through the state certification to be qualified, certified city police chief, and there are a number of things they have to go through on the law enforcement side. Be accredited to be a police chief of a municipality. Then after that, we'll probably start taking applications and interviews for the rest of the department, create policy. We're going to take our cars and restripe them and relogo them and set up the department, set up the court system.
Taneytown's new police force comes as the city's interlocal agreement with the Washington County Sheriff's Office comes to a close. The agreement ends in March, and Granata says that the new department will have 6 full-time employees.
The Benton County Convenience Center will continue its recycling operations at the Benton County Solid Waste District's facility in Centerton. That comes after the Waste District, at its meeting yesterday, extended the agreement with the county. Teresa Sidwell is the program coordinator for the county's Environmental Services Department. She says the arrangement with the Solid Waste District allows the county to offer services it couldn't offer on its own.
We used to have it at a different location, and we weren't able to offer those services to citizens very often because of that. And since the Solid Waste District has the facility there already, it was convenient for them to go ahead and take over those services for us and offer that to the citizens. It's went really well out there. It's well received with the citizens. People are starting to find out what it's all about and where they can bring their recyclables. And I think that most Benton County citizens are starting to take advantage of it.
Sidwell says that the convenience center offers free recycling of items such as electronics, appliances, e-waste, metal, and bulky waste free to all county residents.
Fort Smith's heritage as a town of the Wild West is being recognized on a national scale. True West magazine has named the city the number one 2013 True Western Town. According to the CityWire.com, the designation is based upon an application that was compiled by a committee of local historians and other people familiar with the city's Western heritage. The Fort Smith National Historic Site, the future U.S. Marshals Museum, and the statue of Wild West lawman Bass Reeves are just a few landmarks of the city's Wild West heritage.
And Fort Smith is also being recognized as one of the fastest-growing small metro areas in the country. In a study released by Smart Growth America, the organization compared the city and suburb population growth rates of several small metropolitan statistical areas. Fort Smith was third on the list with a growth rate of 1.01% within the city, compared to a growth rate of 1.3% in the city's suburban population. What that means is between 2010 and 2011, the population in the city limits of Fort Smith grew more than seven times faster than it did in the rest of Sebastian, Crawford, LaFleur, and Sequoia counties. Only the Clarksville, Tennessee, and Lexington, Kentucky metro areas saw faster growth rates in their cities compared to their suburban areas.
If you plan on attending this Saturday's commencement ceremony at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, be prepared to arrive a little bit early. Security procedures will be expanded because of the presence of Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus, who is one of three guest speakers scheduled to address the more than 800 undergraduate, graduate, and law students who finish their degrees during the fall or summer semesters. The ceremony begins at 9 a.m., but guests should allow extra time to pass through a security checkpoint. And for those who aren't attending, you can still watch the commencement as the ceremony will be streamed live online. For more information, visit newswire.uark.edu.
Our own Jeff Palmer will be
graduating
his diploma at that Saturday morning event. Clear tonight, early, then mostly cloudy. Lows around 30 in northwest Arkansas, mid-30s tonight for the Arkansas River Valley. Clouds tomorrow, 20% chance of rain. Highs tomorrow, mid-50s. And for Friday night, mostly cloudy, 60% chance of rain. Lows in the mid-40s in northwest Arkansas. Overcast and a 50-50 chance of rain tomorrow night in the Arkansas River Valley. Lows in the mid-40s.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the federal government may have to pay millions of dollars in damages to the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission after a U.S. Army Corps of Engineer-operated dam chronically flooded agency property. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The Black River, a tributary to the White, flows from southeastern Missouri into northeastern Arkansas. The Arkansas Game and Fish Commission in the late 1950s began to purchase hardwood habitat along the river to both provide top-quality waterfowl hunting in eastern Arkansas, as well as preserve critical wintering habitat to thousands of migratory birds, including neotropicals. The bottomland forest features a wealth of oak trees, nuttall, pin, and water oaks, as well as bald cypress, tupelo, and willow grow along the sloughs that drain the area. Today, the 23,000-acre Dave Donaldson Black River Wildlife Management Area spans Clay, Randolph, and Greene counties, the largest contiguous timber parcel like it on the upper Mississippi alluvial valley. But starting back in 1993 and over the next 6 years, portions of the preserve were flooded by a U.S. Army Corps of Engineer-operated dam built 40 years earlier upstream on Clearwater Lake. In 2005, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission sued the U.S. government for damages. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was the named defendant, but the U.S. Department of Justice argued the case. It eventually reached the U.S. Supreme Court, and earlier this month, the court ruled in the State Commission's favor. James Goodhart is general counsel for the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission.
During the years between 1993 through 1999, caused significant damage to the timber. We had protested the flooding. The Corps eventually in 2001 ceased the water deviating from the dam and returned back to their historical flow of the from the dam and into the Black River, and at that point we discussed settling for the damages to do rehabilitation of the management area, and we were unfortunately unsuccessful getting the Corps to pay any damages.
Game and Fish first filed suit in U.S. Court of Federal Claims. That court found the Corps' actions had destroyed habitat and recreation opportunities and degraded more than 18 million board feet of timber. the court awarded Game and Fish $5.78 million, along with interest, court, and attorney's fees. The U.S. government appealed the case in federal circuit court, which overturned the award decision, saying the damage resulted from a temporal event.
The Federal Circuit Court of Appeals reversed because they held that under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution that this was not a taking that was compensable because it had been in a temporary time period, approximately 6 years.
That takings clause under the Fifth Amendment regards the right of eminent domain for public projects like highways or parks, for which landholders are compensated. But the clause also stipulates that if state property sustains physical invasion, just compensation must be paid.
And we applied to the U.S. Supreme Court in November of last year. They granted our request for certiorari on April the 2nd of this year.
And so on December 4th, the U.S. Supreme Court, with one justice abstaining, ruled 8-0 in favor of the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. Precedent.
We're pleased the Supreme Court ruled the way they did. They held that flooding of the nature that occurred in Arkansas over a six-year time period was compensable under our Fifth Amendment takings clause, and that is the way we had argued and believed it to be. The trial judge agreed and awarded the damages, and it's a victory for our agency and for landowners across the country that can be protected under our Constitution when damages that are not permanent in duration occur, but nevertheless are substantial and are worthy of being paid for, compensated by our government.
In the ruling, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, writing for the court, stated that government acquisition or invasion of property can be a taking, even when temporary in nature, and that if the impact is severe enough, that can amount to a taking of property warranting just compensation. The cause of the prolonged flooding on Arkansas state land can be traced to a Missouri member of Congress requesting that the Corps release excess water to aid Missouri soybean farmers on low-lying land near the dam. So when will Arkansas Game and Fish Commission see its $5.78 million compensatory award?
As it stands, the Supreme Court remanded to the Federal Circuit to address remaining issues that the United States had raised regarding the trial decision. Our agency also raised a cross appeal to ask for additional damages of $5 million more additional damages for needed rehabilitation, replanting, reforestation, so to speak, of our management area. So those remaining issues have to be addressed by the Federal Circuit, and then hopefully the judgment will be upheld and, frankly, will be increased.
But with this Supreme Court decision, says Arkansas Game and Fish Commission counsel James Goodhart, downstream property owners should now be more confident the U.S. Constitution is working in their favor.
I think the decision means that landowners, and including public land that's natural resource protected land, can be better protected. Our government, in making decisions, will understand that before those decisions affect landowners, flood and take property, interfere with the uses of those properties, that those decisions will be done with proper investigation and minimize the kind of damage that can occur from flood control downstream flooding of land. And so from that standpoint, all landowners that are downstream of any dam or water control structure should feel relieved.
When queried, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said it was unable to comment as the case is subject to continuing litigation. But a group of private landowners downstream from a Corps dam site along the White River who've been chronically flooded but don't wish to be identified on the record at this time are looking into a similar lawsuit. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Hello, this is Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday night from 10 till midnight. On this week's show, I will feature two very special CDs and two interviews to go along with that. Mr. Brad Henderson of Tulsa, Oklahoma has a new CD, a Christmas jazz CD called Christmas Off the Charts. I'll interview Brad and we'll hear some of his music. And from Tahlequah, Oklahoma, Mr. Tommy Poole, who is the director of the Jazz Studies program there, he'll talk with me about the new recording from the NSU Jazz Ensemble called On Cue. We'll also hear music from Don Byron, Richard Whiteman, Houston Person, Paul Winter, and much more. That's Shades of Jazz every Friday night from 10 till midnight.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Earlier this week, two of the people who work at the Office of Education Policy, the OEP at the University of Arkansas, joined us in the Furman Garner Performance Studio.
Correct. Michael Crouch is the school performance evaluator, and Dr. Gary Ritter is the director of that office.
The OEP at the University of Arkansas, along with the Northwest Arkansas Council, this week released the 2012 Northwest Arkansas report card.
Right. It kind of evaluates how schools in the area are doing in comparison to the rest of the state and the nation.
And it's fair to say that the intent of this, so this is all publicly available information. The intent of this is to actually create more questions than answers.
Right.
I think the first way to look at this is it tells you what data are available about the schools. And I think that's important. I would caution almost immediately not to draw evaluative conclusions from just looking at the raw data. So, for example, a snapshot might show that Bentonville has higher raw scores than Prairie Grove. And we wouldn't necessarily want to look at that and say, oh, therefore Bentonville must be doing something better than Prairie Grove. Because as the data show and the report shows, we're serving different student populations district by district by district. So we want to pay attention to all of that. However, you might look at this, and some of the superintendents in the more rural schools have said to us, this is nice that the data are compiled. In fact, they'd like more of their rural districts highlighted here. They said, oh, you know, that's a school district that looks like us, and they seem to be doing better in science than we are. Maybe we should get together and see what's going on. And again, these are data that anyone could look up. We pulled publicly available data from the web, but those folks are too busy running schools. That's their job. Their job isn't to gather data.
So. Well, I was about to ask. I prefaced that with lay people, but apparently there are people that are, you know, elbow deep in education administration that haven't seen all these figures together.
I think that's right, and I think it's because they're elbow deep in education
they don't
administration.
Have the time.
they're very busy doing their job, and we have the really good fortune of being paid to gather data and analyze data and ask questions that we find interesting. And in fact, I would suggest that we use these data more to generate questions than to derive certain answers.
And one thing that when we were planning this report, we wanted it to tell a story. Start at the very beginning. Everyone starts out in their own community. So we start off with community profiles. Then we tell the story of the test for younger children, the benchmark, the ITBS. Then we go on to high school indicators, then on to college. So we try to see, what does it look like for a student growing up in the Northwest Arkansas region?
So it's not only a compilation for administrators that just don't have time, but also for people that are considering moving here with their families.
I think that's the original purpose for the report. So the Northwest Arkansas Council, who has sponsored this report for the past couple of years, they were interested in just organizing the data on the region because they had forever dealt with employees who were thinking of moving here whose spouses or significant others said, you're not moving me to Arkansas. Or parents with young kids who said, I don't want to go there because of the schools. There's some perception of what the schools are. Our schools statewide end up roughly in the middle, slightly below the national average, which isn't bad when you take into account that we deal with a higher rate of poverty than most states. But nevertheless, the business leaders in the region, folks who are trying to recruit talent here, wanted to have some document that says, look, these districts that you might be concerned with, they've got kids scoring at the 60th percentile in science across the nation, not just in Arkansas, but across the nation. And so that's the benefit perhaps for the wider population.
You mentioned student population and district profiles. And of the big five, three of them have grown considerably over the last 7 years. I mean, Bentonville, their student population grew 53%. Springdale, 34%. Siloam Springs, 20%. What challenges are facing these districts?
Rogers and Springdale and Siloam were dealing with a large number of students who speak English as a second language, and they're having to figure out how to work, particularly with literacy with these students, but of course that can be challenging in every subject area. And in particular, Rogers seems to be doing a really nice job with that when we look at their subgroup data, when we look at the data of the kids who are free and reduced lunch, who are limited English proficiency students. They're doing remarkably well compared to other limited English proficiency students or other free and reduced lunch students across the state. The growth challenges in Bentonville are slightly different. They don't have the large fraction of high poverty students or limited English proficiency students, but they do have just enormous growth. And they had to deal with that a year ago. You probably followed it when they decided if they were going to continue with one mega school, build a few small schools around a mega school, or split up the one mega school into two kind of mega schools. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what they chose to do. And so there's all sorts of challenges with growth that need to be met. And in fact, if you look at these stats, you might look at Bentonville and say, it's great for everyone. Look at the test scores. But if your option is one gigantic high school, it's certainly likely that there are a few kids who, even if their test scores are good, might prefer a different environment. The education community is reacting to that in Bentonville and trying to create options so more kids are satisfied and learning well.
You mentioned that people should really use caution if they're using this report card to evaluate things. Human nature being human nature, people will look at numbers and compare. Does it make you wince at all knowing that you're putting out a report card that some people will use in an evaluative way?
That's a great question, and we have that a lot, because a lot of what we do is we create databases where in our Office for Education Policy at the websites, we have databases listing every school district in the state with their scores, and one could simply use Excel to rank from highest to lowest and draw conclusions. What we do to try and mediate that is we make sure to put context data very near the testing data as we do across this report. We also suggest and say every time we're asked, we shouldn't make evaluative statements just on these data alone. Nevertheless, if the other option is to not share data, and we have decided that our mission at the Office for Education Policy is to help make information transparent, make data transparent. So yes, it does make me wince, but hiding data would make me wince more.
One of our latest efforts is an idea called a similar schools index. We try to compare, like it says, a similar school to an apples-to-apples comparison. For example, one school district that is large and in a low-poverty area shouldn't be compared to a small, high-poverty area school.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, you have teacher pay, you have amount of teachers that have more than a bachelor's, and you have scores. There's that idea that, oh, I can connect two easy dots and I come up with this answer. But that's exactly not what should be done.
I think what we're hoping is it generates questions. So we might see a pattern that appears in the data, and then ideally a school leader or one of us or someone who sees it or a newspaper reporter might approach and say, hey, does this appear to be true? And we have all the data where we can conduct slightly more sophisticated analysis to try and tease out these other indicators, as you suggested, poverty, school size, other socioeconomic stuff, to try and figure out, is there a true pattern? And we also, it's hard for our eyes to recognize a pattern. We might look at three schools and say, oh, it looks like there's a pattern there. Well, you're not going to derive a true pattern off of three schools, but with 1,100 schools in the state, we may be able to see if there is a true pattern.
And when we're looking at those 1,100 schools and in comparison to Northwest Arkansas, 13 out of the 17 school districts in Northwest Arkansas scored better than Arkansas as a state. And you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier with talking about how Arkansas is kind of in the 50th percentile nationwide. To me, that doesn't seem like, you know, that's that great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 50% is good. And if you're a native Arkansan, it's better than it's been. But it's no reason to rest.
It's certainly no reason to rest statewide. While we're, and 50% is a bit generous. We're a bit below average.
Okay.
Okay.
But still, it's comparison to the common lore. That's not the case. So, but you're right. There's certainly no reason to rest by any means. There are lots of innovations we can engage in that would have a chance to result in better outcomes. And maybe they wouldn't. In social science research, it's hard to find stuff that works. We find more things that don't work than do work. All I think we can hope for are a set of policymakers and leaders who continue to try new things, keep an eye on the data as they try new things, and hold themselves accountable so that they're willing to discard things when they don't work. There are pockets of excellence. There are areas where our kids are performing at the 70th percentile, the 65th percentile. Then again, even in some of our perceived to be best districts, we can look and see graduation rates that are around 80 to 85%. So even in areas of relative affluence in this town in which we sit, 15% of the kids who start in ninth grade are not completing high school with a degree. That's really bad news.
If one of the statewide goals is to get more people with bachelor's degrees, a higher percentage, having 15% who are not getting a high school degree seems problematic.
I think so. And in this project, we've been engaged a great deal with folks in the higher ed world, and we're learning that the higher ed world doesn't consist of only four-year degrees or nothing else. But it's possible that this is the message lots of kids go to high school with. So one reason, and this is conjecture and not based on great data, it's based on experience. Nevertheless, one hypothesis we're generating is that it's not surprising that kids in high school exit out if they don't feel like they're interested in a four-year college degree, and the signal they're getting is four-year college degree is it. Otherwise, there's no reason to be hanging around here. There are lots of good options, even in this area, for post-secondary schooling, which aren't four-year degrees, and lots of good jobs that would be connected to them for kids after they graduate. And the idea, I don't believe, is that we need to train kids for the economy, but I think we need to set up our schools so the kids have the ability to make choices when they're older.
You also looked at some of the three major institutions of higher learning in the two counties, JBU, University of Arkansas, and Northwest Arkansas Community College. There was something called institutional cost effectiveness. Help me out.
Sure. So this is a measure that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce originally came up with, and the idea is looking at out of the degrees completed, so not just how many students go in, but how many diplomas are actually handed out at the end of the day, a six-year graduation rate for a four-year institution. And out of that, how much money was spent on that? First, you have the overall money that was spent on it, but also there's good government records that are kept on how much money the state, local, or federal dollars go towards those schools and those degrees. So then we're able to do a little bit of math and come up with this institutional cost effectiveness number. How much of that money is being spent on each degree completed, and then how much of that money is coming from a state, local, federal entity. And it provides some interesting data on how efficient we are with our educational system, and also how many of those students we're retaining. One, you could either spend less money in order to get a degree, or you could graduate more students. If you're doing your job to the best of your ability, you're graduating more students and bringing the dividing number up to give you a lot better return for your money.
We're now beginning the Arkansas Scholarship Lottery has been around a couple of years. We had two freshman classes.
It started in 2010.
It was passed in 2008. The initial scholarships went out in 2010, yes.
So the people who were freshmen in 2010 and people who were freshmen in 2000.
Right. So if you graduated high school in 2010, you're a college freshman 2010-11.
So we're in the third class now.
And you include the statistics on how many of those have been renewed.
And those are simple descriptive statistics. You would expect that those who renew were smarter to begin with. On the margin, they're going to be better students. But being on one side of the margin or the other doesn't guarantee that you're going to get your scholarship renewed. A lot of doing well in college is a simple matter of hard work. But overall, we're looking at the numbers and what type of predictors we can use to predict whether or not they'll retain their scholarship, and then looking at actual college numbers to see how they did.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Michael Crouch and Gary Ritter are with the Office of Education and Policy at the University of Arkansas. Kyle and I spoke with them earlier this week.
It is Thursday, December 13th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Becca Martin-Brown. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
In 100 years, it could be 12-12-21-12. Did you hear that yesterday?
I did.
Now
I did.
We're under 100 years.
I did.
Oy now
vey.
It's slightly under 100 years.
99 years, 364
days. I think you really
days.
Ought to try writing comedy. I think there's a Santa Land Diaries
no.
in you.
No. No. I'm only funny to people who know me. And then I'm marginally so.
And then it's either funny or strange.
Exactly.
We're not sure. Speaking of Santa Land Diaries, how is that for a segue?
Very, very well done.
Mark Landon Smith is back on stage in this one-man show. The script is based on an essay by David Sedaris, who, as National Public Radio put it, went from obscurity to sought-after talent almost overnight after he read from his experiences as a 41-year-old Macy's elf on Morning Edition in December 1992.
I still remember. I was anchoring Morning Edition back then at KUAF, and I still remember that morning because it was so mind-blowing that this was on the air, and it was so funny.
It is the funniest. Okay, this is not your grandma's Christmas show.
No.
Be very clear on this. It is for a mature audience. It is David Sedaris.
Right.
It's risque. It's risky. It's all kinds of things.
It's very funny, though.
But it is the funniest thing you will ever hear.
And Mark Landon Smith
is the funniest person
funny
you'll ever meet.
Yeah, he is.
It is tonight at 7 o'clock. Well, the doors open at 7, showtime at 7:30 at the UARC Bowl in Fayetteville. Again tomorrow night and Saturday night, your only chances for this year. It's $12. Do things in dozens again today. Spend $12.
There you go.
And go get a ticket because you will laugh until you can't breathe.
Plus cash bar.
Sounds good. Thanks, right. Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
On this week's Generic Blue Show, I have Jones and Leah. Eben Jones and Leah Spears came in the studio this week. Actually even played a couple Christmas tunes. Hear all about it Friday night at 9 o'clock. The Generic Blue Show. We'll see you then.
If you can't get your fill of holiday music in the region this year, you may never be able to. In a few moments, Jody Beznoska from Walton Arts Center will give us that venue's list of Christmas offerings. Sunday afternoon, the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra will be in the Arendt Arts Center in Bentonville for their annual holiday show. This week, the conductor of the APO, Stephen Bias, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to discuss the program.
This year, I have invited two soloists, two dynamic vocal soloists, Laurie Gale Stevenson and Steve Amerson, to sing with us. They've been together for many years. Laurie Gale Stevenson, a Broadway veteran, began singing on Broadway in The Secret Garden, and then was handpicked by Andrew Lloyd Webber to sing the leading role in Phantom of the Opera. She has since sung for Stephen Sondheim's 75th birthday celebration, done some amazing work with Michael Crawford in several of the Andrew Lloyd Webber shows, sings with orchestras, and is an amazing, wonderful presence. Steve Amerson is known as America's tenor, sings opera, operetta, musical theater, has sung in over 160 movies in Hollywood, now beginning to do animation voiceover, also sings inspirational music, and is one of those extraordinary talents who is one of the finest singers with whom I've ever worked. They put together a collection of holiday favorites, many traditional things that have been given a new spin with a different arrangement or a different style that we present these tunes. And we've also invited the dynamic and Fayetteville's own McNair Middle School Glee Club. I heard this group a couple of years ago at 7:30 a.m. before school started, and I was amazed, number one, that their enthusiasm was off the charts at 7:30 in the morning, but that they were singing traditional choral things, but also some show choir and other Broadway things with movement so well and so enthusiastically. And Jenny Alves, their very talented director, has done some wonderful things with this group, and I thought, what a fantastic collaboration if we involve them in the program. So in addition to these two soloists, Steve Amerson and Lori Gill Stevenson, the McNair Middle School Glee Club, plus a few selections that the Arkansas Philharmonic will play. We're also excited to present a new arrangement that Sarah Grafe has done. We premiered a new work for orchestra by Sarah a couple of years ago, and I asked her to create an arrangement for children's choir and orchestra, and she's here and can say some words about that wonderful arrangement.
Where do you begin when you're commissioned?
I think the first thing is deciding what piece to do. With doing an arrangement is very different from writing a new piece from the beginning. And with an arrangement like this, the first question is, okay, what do I set? And I spent a lot of time reading carols, listening to Christmas songs, listening to Christmas carols, and thinking, do I want to do something that's newer, something that's older, something that's more familiar or less familiar? I ended up choosing this Welsh carol called All Through the Night, which is not the same All Through the Night that Cyndi Lauper recorded.
Oh, yeah.
And I chose it for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, it's a lovely tune. I also really liked the words a lot. It's a very sweet story about, you know, children sleeping through the night and the angels watching over them and keeping them safe and protected. And I liked also that it's something that sometimes is used simply as a lullaby and not just at Christmas time, but it does tend to be sung more around Christmas time. I like that it's something that when you say this to people, people go, oh, yeah, I think I know that. And as soon as you sing a measure from it, they say, oh, yes, I know that. And I like that it's familiar but not commonplace.
Right.
So that's where I started with this one. Also, it wasn't scary. Some of the stories were really scary. So, you know, I try to avoid things with scary words in them and things like that.
Well, let me sing Sarah's praises about the actual arrangement style, and perhaps you can say a few words. It's required virtually 99% of the time to do some tweaking in the orchestra for balance because children's voices will not project over a professional symphony orchestra. They don't have the carrying power to do that. And Sarah has orchestrated this work in such a way that I must just have the orchestra play. And it's beautiful what she's done. And perhaps you could say a few words about what you've done to orchestrate this in the most perfect fashion.
Well, there's a lot to live up to.
The most perfect.
Perfect, absolutely. Well, there are a lot of things that you have to think about, whatever you're writing in terms of balance. And in this situation, you want to think about orchestrating something so that it's lush and beautiful, but it doesn't overpower the children. And some of the things that I think about are perhaps things that I learned about in my background doing film scoring and things like that, where you want to stay out of the same register where the children are singing at that moment, so that the instruments that you hear are often playing higher or lower than where the children are singing, keeping things where you have large groups of people playing, but perhaps the strings are playing pizzicato so that it's brief and it allows the children's voices to shine through in between the notes and things like that. So it does take a lot of careful consideration and detail to make sure that it really highlights the kids.
And that careful consideration is immediately apparent because the accompaniment is gossamer-like and absolutely perfect for the kids. Not only is it a balance issue, but within the context and the emotional context of the text, it's perfect because it is very gentle, something that will be a very warm sound, but one, again, that's gossamer-like, that creates absolutely no balance issues. So it's brilliantly done, and I'm excited about performing it.
What's it like to hear it for the first time?
Oh, that's the best part. I mean, that's kind of what I live for as a composer, is hearing somebody else take my music and really perform it. And having a conductor like Steven to do this is such a gift because he's so good. He's so gifted, and the orchestra loves playing with him. And so those really are the moments that I live for. I think even the first rehearsal, maybe even more so than the performance itself.
Just because it's so
exciting.
Illuminating.
Yeah.
I imagine it's like a neon light coming on or something.
It is, definitely, definitely. And you think, oh my gosh, I can't believe that worked. And other times you think things worked better than I expected them to, and other things didn't work maybe quite as well as I expected them to. But I think the best part are the happy accidents, the surprises that I wasn't really even expecting, and it's very exciting.
Sarah Grafe and Stephen Baez talked to Kyle earlier this week. The Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra's Christmas concert is Sunday afternoon at 2 at the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville.
It is the 13th day of December 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And with us is Jody Beznoska, who is Vice President for Communications at Walton Arts Center. Welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. You guys have this gauntlet. It's already
yes,
started.
It has started. It started, when did it start? It started Tuesday, really,
right.
with
Billy.
Well,
Billy
actually,
Elliott?
It started with Billy Elliott, right. which was last week. But that's so last week. No, we had Mannheim Steamroller a couple days ago.
Right.
Crosschurch had their show last night. And then I don't think we have anything tonight. I may be wrong about
I
that.
I think you're right.
But tomorrow we have a great little program for kids, for little kids, ages probably 3 to 6, maybe a little bit older. It's not a Christmas show per se, but I don't know if you guys have been in and seen our lobby at Walton Arts Center yet. It is decorated to the nines for the holidays, so it feels very Christmassy. And this is a lovely little poetry show. It's called Guess How Much I Love You and I Love My Little Storybook. These are obviously beloved children's books that have been turned into a play. And it is done by probably one of our favorite children's theater companies. We've had them multiple times. It's called the Mermaid Theater of Nova Scotia.
Puppets. Oh, yeah.
And they just have this knack for building shows that engage that young age. You know, some shows are meant for kids, but these are designed for kids. These are, you know, they know how to reach into a kid's imagination and get them to pay attention. It's going to be fantastic.
Well, I think love is sort of Christmassy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
Very, yeah.
And magic and yeah. You know, friendship and all those wonderful
right.
things. So it's gonna be delightful. It's a 6:30 show, so it's gonna be a little tough if you're coming down from up north.
Yeah, but if it's a 7:30 show, it's gonna be a little tough if you're 3 to 6.
Right,
so.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's 6:30, and the tickets are pretty affordable. So it would be a nice night out for your kids if you're looking for something for Friday night. So that's Friday. Mm-hmm. Then Saturday, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, SONA, will do their Christmas Pops concert. There, as of the last time I checked, there weren't any tickets. So now is the time for us to start talking about what we do in that scenario, which is if you come to the box office an hour before the show, we will put you on a waiting list, on a standby list, and if tickets open up for some reason, either they get turned back or something opens because, you know, a hold got released, then we'll get you in. But it's going to be tight. But it's so exciting, so wonderful for SONA to have that. So that would be Saturday. I believe that is a 7:30 show.
Yes.
At the same time, the second week of Theater Squared's Period of Adjustment is going on.
Right.
That show is going to run through the 30th of December. It's really good. Wonderful show. Really well done. Very sweet, very poignant, and just very, very smart, very worthwhile seeing. So that's Period of Adjustment, which I believe is running through December 30th with Theater Squared. You can get tickets for that at the Walton Arts Center website. Then on Sunday the 16th, we will have Winona's Rockin' Christmas. Tickets are going fast for that one, so get them if you want to go. On Monday the 17th, we'll have Jim Brickman on A Winter's Night. He's another favorite of ours. He comes back every couple of years.
He'll be on the show in just a few minutes, actually.
Oh, yeah. That's cool. That's wonderful. And then on the 20th, we will have the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, The Creole Christmas. I can't wait for that one.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to that
one. Yeah. I've been looking forward to that one since the last time Preservation Hall was here a couple years ago. And then on the 21st through the 23rd, that's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So leading right up to Christmas Eve, we will have 4 performances of the Nutcracker. So a Friday night, a matinee on Saturday, an evening show on Saturday, and a matinee on Sunday. There are tickets left for those shows, but they are flying out the door. So if you plan to do this, if this is a tradition for you and your family, don't wait. Get those tickets now as soon as you can.
Who is the Nutcracker?
It's being done by the Moscow Classical Ballet. Okay. But that is the 21st through the 23rd. And then it's Christmas. And we go away for a couple of weeks from in terms of productions and performances. Our box office is still going to be open, so you can get tickets to all of the January and February shows during that time. And if you are looking for a gift, I would recommend our next Broadway show, which is Catch Me If You Can. We've talked a little bit about this. This is a Broadway musical based on the DreamWorks film. And the film featured Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hanks. And it's a chase movie. Mm-hmm. It's a con man movie. And this, I don't understand whose idea it was to think of taking that movie and making it into a musical. But apparently it works. and it's a big, bright, colorful musical. And what I think would be fun about this, if you're giving gifts, is that this is a show that I think both members of a couple would like. You know how sometimes guys get dragged to shows and they don't like them for some reason? I think this one will appeal to both because it's got the chase story, it's got some really fun songs, it's got bright colors, good big dancing numbers, lots of kick lines and all kinds of fun things. So it's that runs from the 8th through the 13th of January. And it's one of those newer Broadway mm-hmm. shows that I think maybe people haven't heard of as a Broadway show, but I'm hoping people will take a chance on it because it's one of those ones that once you get in the theater, you're going to have a riot. It's really going to be fun. So that's from the 8th through the 13th. And the box office is actually going to be open on Christmas Eve. So if you're a last minute shopper, come on in, buy some tickets, make somebody happy.
WaltonArtsCenter.org.
Correct. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets or come down and visit us. We still have the 20 years exhibition up in our gallery with Kathy Thompson's work. That is going down in a couple of weeks. So if you want to see that, come by and visit.
All right. Thank you, Jody.
Thank you.
Jody Besnoska is Vice President of Communications for Walton Arts Center.
We're deep in the snowy woods for the holiday party of our lives with some of our favorite musicians. It's All Songs Considered for the Holidays. I'm Bob Boylan. Join us for the holiday tradition filled with songs from old friends and new favorites. All Songs Considered for the Holidays from NPR Music.
A holiday-packed edition of All Songs Considered at a special time, Sunday at noon on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Jim Brickman is a composer, an arranger, an entertainer, an entrepreneur, basically a force of nature. The pianist is one of the most commercially successful musicians in history. Monday night, he'll bring his On a Winter's Night concert to Walton Arts Center. This week, I asked him, as he was preparing for a concert in Morgantown, West Virginia, if he had to be at the piano when creating a new arrangement for a holiday standard.
It's a stylistic thing that, you know, I feel like is my stock and trade in a way. I mean, it's just the way that I approach a lot of these carols. And the thing about the hymns and carols when you're a songwriter is that, you know, they're very short and very simple. So a lot of times I will, you know, rewrite a B section of the song or a turnaround. And so you always come back to the theme, but it's theme and variations on familiar classics. And that's one of the great things that you're able to do as an instrumentalist that you can't as a singer, because you know, when you interpret instrumental versions of these songs, you don't have to stick completely to the exact melody and yet at the same time, you get the essence of the familiarity of the melody. You know, like Silent Night or God Rest You Merry Gentlemen or First Noel, you can take all kinds of wonderful liberties and still have it at the core be the carol.
And you come around, I know that on All Is Calm, O Come All Ye Faithful, the first few bars, if you're not looking at the title, you might not instantly recognize it, but boy, then you get there, don't you?
Yeah, you always, you know, it's like the first rule of thumb for a writer, I think, is to always establish the theme, you know, because that's what's familiar to people when you're playing other people's music. But even when I write my own, it's very important to make a statement about, you know, this is what this experience is going to be like. And I feel the same way about the live show. It's with intention. You can't do it haphazardly, just get up on stage and just play whatever. You have to think through about what the listening experience is going to be, what the live experience, and how that's different from the putting a CD on at home. And it's you use it in different ways and for different reasons.
When you're arranging something that's familiar, be it a Christmas carol or a lullaby, you know when you're doing the arrangement where the heart is and what's the familiar part. When you're composing your own, is it a different process of trying to find the heart of that particular piece?
It's not as much for me anymore because I'm very hook-driven as a songwriter. I mean, to me, establishing the theme, the hook, the core of the song is a really important quality to an original piece. I think a lot of times when people write songs who are just beginning, that they tend to write all over the place, or they tend to write from the beginning. And I don't really write a song from the beginning. I always write the theme first and then establish it, you know, decide where in the song to establish the core melody and theme, but it always has to have one. Otherwise, it becomes ambient. And I always think, you know, I'm a pop songwriter, so I always have to establish the hook.
What's the thing that you hope people who come to Walton Arts Center and your other concerts, your performances, take away? That, you know, a couple hours later and they're walking out of the venue, what do you hope they have?
I feel like I hope they walk out going, I laughed, I cried, and you know, and I escaped for a few hours.
You mentioned laugh. You read up about you, and one thing people say is you're funny. You're a witty guy.
Only on stage. I don't think my friends and my parents and, you know, my family think that it's something that I don't know. I think if you are who you are, and you're really authentic on stage, people get much more of a glimpse of authenticity. And sometimes, you know, life is funny, and I would say it's more of a storytelling. It's not jokes. You know, I'm not a comedian, but I think it's sort of a sardonic tone, and I just say what comes to my mind, and I think sometimes that comes out humorous, I hope.
Monday night at 7 at Walton Arts Center, Jim Brickman on a winter's night. Mr. Brickman, thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Jim Brickman will perform Monday night at 7 at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, and Ginger Blue, Missouri.
No. Ginger Blue, Missouri?
Ginger Blue, Missouri.
Where is Ginger Blue, Missouri?
It's directly west of Pineville.
Really?
Yes.
Directly west of Pineville. Mm-hmm. So darn near Oklahoma,
right.
Too.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of around Southwest City.
Yes. Yeah.
Ginger Blue. All right.
I liked it. It's kind of, I mean, you could have a dog named Ginger Blue.
I'm sure someone has. That sounds like a hit from the 1970s. Like the Ozark Mountain Daredevils would have had the song Ginger Blue.
Right.
That's 2 weeks in a row you've come up with a very
and
good one.
And it's someplace else I want to go. I want to go there.
We're going to do a whole show where all we do is go to places like Peter Pender and Ginger Blue.
Right. I like it.
Okay, that's a resolution for 2013. KUAF and the Fort Smith Chorale will present an a cappella Christmas next Thursday morning at 11. It was a concert recorded live November 29th in Fort Smith. It'll bring you into the Christmas season with your favorite carols, Good King Wenceslas, How Unto Bethlehem, Deck the Halls, We Three Kings, and more. That's an a cappella Christmas from the Fort Smith Chorale next Thursday morning at 11 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Boy, if you want Christmas... This region always has the shows, but I mean, you know, if you just listen to the last 20 minutes
so
of our
much.
Show, and we didn't even begin to cover everything. I've asked you before your favorite Christmas carol, haven't I?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Which I didn't even know the name. I still don't know the name to it. I just know how it goes.
Gloria.
Right. Right.
Okay. Let's see. Antoinette and I will be back tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You and I Sunday morning at 9 for
yes.
Weekend Ozarks at Large. And then in a couple weeks, we'll have that annual week where we kind of our favorite stories. That'll be the week of Christmas in this spot.
I like that, too.
I do, too. And thanks. Jody Beznoska also brought us cookies.
She did. I had cookies for kind of mid-morning
yes.
snack today.
New rule. All guests bring cookies. Thanks a lot. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUF. I'm Kyle Kellens.
I'm Christina Thomas.